Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Has pop culture prepared Americans to embrace extreme politics? In the new book, The Sky is Falling, cultural journalist Peter Biskin dives headlong into two decades of popular culture, from superhero franchises such as The Dark Knight, X-Men, and The Avengers, and series like The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones, to thrillers like Homeland and 24, and emerges to argue that these shows are saturated with the values that are currently animating our extreme politics. Biskin shows how extreme culture now calls the shots. It has become, he believes, the new mainstream. The book is The Sky is Falling, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Peter Biskin to this week's book show. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe, for inviting me.
You lay the groundwork here to help us come to realize that TV, movies, the media that we consume is laying the groundwork for the political extremism that we see today. How did you come to that working theory?
Well, I've always been, writing about movies and television, and I've always felt that they had more impact than they're giving credit for. At least since Karl Marx, culture has been trivialized as a causative factor in social change. Marx, of course, privileged economics, and of course there are a million other factors like demographics and migrations and so forth. But I've always believed that culture was important, and in fact, there have recently been cognitive studies to show the importance of storytelling, narratives, or formation of belief, and in certain ways, it's more powerful than, people hectoring you about what you should think and what you shouldn't think.
So when it comes to these ideas, as you say in the introduction of the book, when we think of an agent of change, that culture has often been treated rather shabbily, you list some really key moments where that started to change, and you saw that, wow, culture had a lot more power than that.
Well, I mean, I think it's often been true. It's hard to pinpoint a specific date. I mean, in the book I cite, Uncle Tom's Cabin, as a important element in convincing the North to go to war against the South in the Civil War. There are other instances of that. Birth of a Nation, 1915. Contributed to the rebirth of the Klan. Much more recently, I think in 1962, a film called The Manchurian Candidate actually predicts Trump in a way. I mean, it's about Russian interference in the American elections, and of course, it's a wild and weird plot, but it has eerie resonance right now. I mean, I think culture is a chicken and egg. I certainly wouldn't claim that it was the main causative factor in social change, but it provokes and enhances, I think, social change, even if the impetus comes from elsewhere.
So tell us how you've decided to break up the book. The book is in three parts, and this allows us to explore these three aspects. Talk a little bit about how you decided to segment the book.
Well, the first part is mostly concerned with the apocalypse and apocalyptic thinking. The reason the apocalypse is so important is because it presents an extreme situation where extreme measures seem necessary and the only sane reaction to them. I mean, that's the reason that vampires and zombies play a big role in this, because in those shows, especially a show like The Walking Dead, which is now going into its ninth season and is enormously popular, in a show like that, people are thrown back into a primitive situation where their behavior becomes problematical. And the question that show asks is any possible? Is any behavior justified? In other words, does anything go to save your life, ensure your survival? Or are there still limits? Are there still standards? Are there still a morality? And that's the question that show asks, some of the vampire shows. Conversely, in what I call mainstream shows, if you have apocalyptic situations, they showcase the effectiveness of the government. You know, the government, you know, a show like World War Z, the CDC works hand in hand with the United Nations and they search for the, you know, patient zero, and they find a cure for the zombie plague, which is caused by a virus. So in mainstream shows, government works. In extremist shows, it doesn't, as to some degree in The Walking Dead, everything collapses. You know, there's no military, there's no internet, there's no cell service, there's nothing. The second part of the book deals with changes in behavior, behavior that was legitimized and codified in most of the history of Hollywood, and starting with the production code in 1930, which made certain kinds of, which prohibited essentially certain kinds of films. But ever since then, you know, there have been standards of behavior that have actually been codified, and that started to change. For example, take the Western, which there was such a thing as the Code of the West, which prevented the Western hero from shooting people in the back, drawing first, shooting women and children, shooting people when they're down. All those kinds of standards were eventually overthrown, mostly by Clint Eastwood in the 1970s in films like Josie Wales, where he told me when I interviewed him once that his editor came to him and said, you know, Clint, you shot somebody in the back. And he said, so what? He said something like that. So what? If you don't shoot somebody in the back, if you don't draw first, you're going to get killed. And he said, I always shoot people in the back. And that was a big step towards normalizing behavior that had been hitherto prohibited. And there's lots of examples of that. Revenge heroes, for example, is a fairly new concept. Revenge used to be forbidden because it was a breach of the rule of law, and the rule of law was one of the major tenets of the mainstream and the center. Ever since Clint Eastwood, and then followed by, you know, Charles Bronson and Mel Gibson and even James Bond, revenge has been okay, and you have such a thing as a revenge hero, where revenge is perfectly okay. The third part of the book explores the causes of the changes in behavior and the changes in standards and the breakdown of the center of the consensus culture that, you know, that ruled America pretty much since World War II up through the Obama administration, with a little detour in the 50s for the Vietnam War. What has caused this transformation of behavior? And in that section of the book, I get into something called the post-human, where a lot of these films and TV shows conclude that people themselves are intrinsically bad, and that you have a lot of instances where the main characters try to escape the human. So I go into that, you know, can they get away from it? And is it possible to escape the human? And what does that mean if it is?
Final section of the book is Heaven Can't Wait. And you look basically at what humans do to get away from the craziness, the strangeness of the world.
Mostly, you know, as I was saying, that in some instances they take extreme measures, which is to say they try to get away from the human. And like in a film like Avatar, for example, which came out in 2009, the main character, the hero, leaves his body, which is dying, and fuses with essentially an alien. That kind of thing happens over and over again in different ways. I mean, you have films in which especially the far-right evangelical films, seek a, you know, the characters seek a oneness with Jesus Christ, which is a similar trope. They, in some sense, find themselves by leaving the human and fusing with a, you know, with a supernatural being. So that kind of behavior, which you see over and over again in a surprising amount, is the main thing they do to sort of escape the predicament they seem to exist in.
One of the most recent examples, and you write about this in the book in that part, is Shape of Water.
Well, Shape of Water is a perfect example of a far-left film because the main character, first of all, the heroes are a trio of, two janitors, one Hispanic and one black, and an out-of-work gay character. In other words, they're low on the totem pole. The villain of the film is an army colonel who has captured a creature from an Amazonian river in the Amazon and brings him to an army lab to experiment on him. And the heroine of the film, played by Sally Hawkins, falls in love with the creature, and the creature falls in love with her. And at the end of the film, she not only helps the creature escape, but she goes underwater to live with it. And she not only betrays America, because the American army has been doing experiments on the creature, but she betrays her species, which is the same thing that happens in Avatar, where the main character betrays his species. And she transformed herself. She has three little parallel marks on her neck at the beginning of the film, scars. And once she goes to live with the creature underwater, they become gills. So she actually transforms herself into another species. So it's a perfect example of escaping the human.
Peter Biskind is our guest. The name of the new book is The Sky is Falling, How Vampires, Zombies, Androids, and Superheroes Made America Great for Extremism. I want to go through a couple of shows and films and just spotlight them for a moment. You read a lot about Game of Thrones in the book. What is it about that program that makes a case for you?
The argument of the book essentially is that pretty much from the end of World War II through the late 60s and then again in the 70s and 80s and 90s, we had what was called, what I call mainstream or centrist culture. And that culture emphasized, and it was based on some political theories that were elaborated by people like Arthur Schlesinger and Robert Dahl, who's a political scientist. It's based on the idea that America is a melting pot, and they conceptualized it as a big tent which contained many, many ethnicities, religions, people from different nations, and so forth. The idea being that the bigger the tent, the more stable society, and the fewer crazies you had outside the tent, sort of throwing Molotov cocktails inside. So it was a way of achieving political stability, but the not everybody was invited to enter the tent. They had to agree to play by the rules of the center, of the mainstream, and those rules consisted of agreeing to obey, to live under the rule of law, tolerance, diversity, compromise versus principle, things like that. And some people just refused to do it, usually the far left or the far right. In those days, it was communists or on the left and birchers on the right, and they were excoriated as extremists. The thesis of the book is that centrist culture, mainstream culture, imploded eventually, and that what we have now, the cultural landscape is dominated by the extremes. And so one of the pieces of evidence for that is the fact that Avatar is the biggest grossing film of all time, and it came out in 2009, still has not been surpassed. Mm. Game of Thrones is one of the most popular shows on television or on cable or whatever. And I see that as a centrist film as well. I mean, it's set in a country or in a region called Westeros, which is dominated by seven warring kingdoms. Each kingdom is ruled by a family, and the families are constantly fighting with each other. And tribalism, or family, is a characteristic of the extremes. In other words, the center values community more than family. In other words, the loyalty to a greater good rather than it sees small family units, even kinship bonds, as being selfish and counterproductive. Well, Westeros characterizes that these factions are always fighting until zombies invade from the north, called the White Walkers, and that presents a common enemy. And one of the characters, Jon Snow, the King of the North, tries to build coalitions among these different families to fight the zombies, because none of these families by itself could do that, could win. And he gives speeches about, you know, the importance of overcoming loyalty to family in the interest of a greater good. And that is a central tenet of mainstream culture. So for me, that's why I would interpret this series as a centrist or mainstream series. And you can see that the villains of the series, like Queen Cersei, who occupies the Iron Throne, refuses to do that. You know, she puts her family first. For her, the greatest loyalty is loyalty to family. And it's easy to make a jump from that to draw analogies with the current Trump administration, because you can see that Trump pretty much considers family, loyalty to himself and loyalty to family, as a greater good than he owes as president the country at large. From my point of view, from the way I analyze this stuff, is that Trump is an extremist, the same way that Queen Cersei in Game of Thrones is, and the same. I mean, Game of Thrones is about power, even though it's set in God, you know, in a mythical country. It's really about politics and power, like a lot of these shows, and that's why it's a valuable show to analyze.
War often plays a part. You talk about the genre of war films, and you talk about them coming into their own during World War II. And you say they were historically the genre that sorted out issues that divided moderates and extremists. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, war films have become a little less common and less popular than they used to be. But, you know, there's a film called Lone Survivor with Wahlberg. In that film, he plays, I think he's a Navy SEAL. Anyway, he's dropped, he and his team of three or four people are dropped by helicopter into Taliban-controlled territory. And they run across some goat herds, and which raises an ethical dilemma. They assume the goat herds will go and tell the Taliban that they've seen them, they've landed. So do they kill the goat herds, or do they let them go? If they let them go, they risk themselves, their own welfare. And if they kill them, they're violating the rules of war, which prohibit the killing of non-combatants. So Wahlberg takes the high road and says, no, you can't kill them. They're non-combatants. We have to let them go. And he persuades the team to in fact do that. There's a big sort of ethical argument about it. They do let them go, and of course, the goat herds go right to the Taliban and inform them that these Americans have landed, and the squad, except for Wahlberg, is wiped out. Wahlberg seems to have been wrong. They should have killed the goat herds. And in other words, the lesson the film team seems to teach is an extremist lesson, that the rules of war don't actually apply in war. These war films still, in fact, do grapple with those issues. There are other issues the film raises, like, do you save, do you go back for your comrades who have been wounded and left, or do you leave them behind? And that's a big issue in World War II films, and still a big issue. You know, presumably Americans go back for their wounded, and the enemy doesn't, but you know, it varies under the circumstances.
In the conclusion of your book, which is entitled The Return of the Center, you say the more the culture rushes right, the more it invigorates the center. How so? What are we seeing now?
Well, there are a lot of series and movies that start in one place and end in another. And I'm talking about series like, or films like Black Panther, or series like even Game of Thrones or The Walking Dead, which seem to be extremist at the beginning, but veer towards the center by the end. In other words, a series like The Walking Dead, under extreme circumstances, the characters experiment with extreme measures, but they always draw back and give speeches about why these measures don't work and why they need to revert to the rule of law and the same kinds of moral standards that governed pre-zombie society. Same thing with a film like Black Panther. T'Challa, who's the king of Wakanda, maintains his authority by strength and power, armed combat. You know, he has to defeat a series of challengers. It's been received as kind of a left-wing film because of the richness with which it portrays the society and the culture of Wakanda, plus all the Black and African characters, both in front of the camera and behind the camera. But at the very end, actually during the credit sequence, T'Challa appears before the United Nations and makes a plea against tribalism. He says we should all be one tribe. I mean, at the beginning of the film, he's a Wakanda firster, in the same sense that Trump is an America firster. He refuses to share the riches of this country with all the poor African countries that surround it. And by the end of the film, he changes his mind. He recants that and comes out for community and a sort of pan-Africanism, which is completely at odds with the tribalism with which the film started. So in that sense, the film starts in one place and ends in another. I already discussed that in terms of Game of Thrones, but there's a lot of that in a lot of these movies and series. And I think that is a testimony to the fact that there's a kind of reaction or revitalization of the center in response to the rise of the right.
So now for the big ass question that unfortunately I only have allowed a minute or two for you to answer, but it's always the essential question of which came first, the chicken or the egg. So is it our entertainment that reflects who we are, or is it the indicator of who we will become?
Which tells us, not only reflects what we are, but tells us what we are.
Right.
You know, it's an impossible question to answer. So the fact that you saved it till last is... is helpful because, as I said, it's a chicken and egg. I mean, there's an interaction between people create culture, culture creates people, and it's reciprocal. And I don't think it's possible to go beyond that and be more and reach either of the sort of extreme conclusions that either culture makes humans or humans make culture.
So it feels like the sky is falling. Will it always feel that way?
Let's hope not. I mean, we have two major issues. One of them is the extremism in the Trump administration, and the other one is global warming. Hopefully, Trump will pass, but global warming is not going to pass. And in fact, because of that, yeah, the sky may be falling for the foreseeable future. I mean, I don't see any, as the recent book by, I think it was Nathaniel Rich, maintains, we missed the window, we missed the opening to reverse it, which is an extremely pessimistic conclusion, but it seems to be justified.
Is it possible to still just watch these programs for the sheer entertainment?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I didn't mean these categories and notions that I put into this book to be necessarily value judgments. Like one of the most right-wing shows in recent memory, which is now ended, was 24, this series on Fox, which got into a lot of trouble because it freely indulged in torture. I watched it religiously. It was a terrific show, very, very exciting and well-directed. You know, so you can't necessarily use politics as, as an aesthetic index. I mean, especially at the time these things come out, I mean, you know, you can certainly watch these films for and TV series for their entertainment value. I mean, I think to some ways, you know, you've got to, otherwise you'll go crazy.
Again, Peter Biskin's new book is The Sky is Falling, How Vampires, Zombies, Androids, and Superheroes Made America Great for Extremism. The book is published by The New Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program, Bookmark Us for Next Week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.